Hi, this is Steve Levitt.
And I'm Stephen Dubner. Thanks for downloading this Freakonomics Radio podcast.
When we started this a couple years ago, I never imagined we would still be making podcasts 2 years later.
And to your great chagrin or to your great joy, we are?
Well, you do all the work, so it's no problem for me.
Yeah, people think that you spend a lot of time in the radio studio, though.
Let's keep it that way. It doesn't hurt me to have them thinking I'm busy in the radio studio.
Well, division of labor-wise, you know, I do pick your brain a lot.
Yeah, that's easy. I just don't want to have to go places, talk to strangers, things like that.
Yeah, you don't like talking to strangers too much, do you?
Whenever we're together, I'm so glad that you're doing the talking, so I can just mind my own business.
Levitt, what is your favorite thing about doing this podcast?
That you do all the work.
From WNYC and APM, American Public Media, this is Freakonomics Radio, the podcast that explores the hidden side of everything. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
So it's time for another round of FAQs, frequently asked questions, where we answer queries from you, our listeners and readers. And we've got Steve Levitt on the line.
Hey, Dubner.
You really love these, don't you? I mean, it is incredibly fun to have people write with real questions, isn't it?
Yeah, because the questions we get are so strange that you never could have made them up.
What do you think it says about just the age we live in where anybody can find anybody and write to them? Because like in the old days, you know, I used to have crazy questions for authors whose books I read and you couldn't get to them. But now everybody's got our email. You like that idea?
Yeah. You know, the nice thing about email is that it's a high cost for the sender and it's low cost for the receiver. Like compared to, say, talking on the phone, where if somebody calls you and you talk to them, it costs the initiator and the recipient the same amount of time and effort. But if someone wants to go and spend 20 minutes writing an email, we can respond in 30 seconds. That's not a bad trade-off.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this. If someone wants to write an email to you or to us and have a good chance of having it be answered, not necessarily on this podcast, but just, you know, via email or whatever, give people some guidelines. What are the topics or the approaches that you are going to consider worth answering?
The hard part, I think, is just getting us to open the email, right? Because there's so much stuff and you cull through. And so having a good tagline, a clever tagline that piques our interest, I think, is good. Short definitely helps. Long is terrible.
Yeah.
Because you have a theory about books. If you don't get to the end of a book, you will never recommend it to anyone.
That is my
theory. If you don't get to the end of an email, you can't possibly reply.
That is true. Yeah. I do have this theory about books. And I have no idea if it's true because I've looked for data and it's really hard to find. But my view is that, you know, the way that books work best is when you read something and love it and tell someone else about it. And I find that I don't often tell people about books that I read 10 pages of, even though I do that. What about you? Do you finish a lot of books and then tell people about it versus reading a bit and telling people?
Well, I'm not a big finisher, that's for sure, on books. I'm a good starter and a bad finisher.
What share of books that you that come into your possession, either through gift or purchase or whatever, stealing, what share of books that come into your possession do you finish, would you say?
Oh, I'd say ones that I actively go out and ones get myself
that you,
out.
Ones that you start to read, let's say. Forget about ones that you get them in the mail. Books that you start to read, what share do you finish, would you say?
I'd say 5 or 10%, but yeah. I don't really think most books are meant to be read. Most books have so little content that they say the same thing over and over and over. And so unless you're kind of slow, there's no point in reading chapters 7, 8, 9, 10 because they just say the same thing over and over. Now, that's not true of all books, but certainly most business books. Now, obviously, history books are novels you got to finish. So I do, you know, probably I finish half my novels.
Well, you love kind of teenage girl novels. That's kind of your favorite genre.
I know. The Hunger
genre.
Games is next on my list. I haven't had a chance to get to that yet.
Yeah. What are like your favorite series ever in history? Twilight would be number one, you think?
No, I know. Harry Potter was way better than Twilight. Uh-huh. I kind of had a love – you know I had a love-hate relationship with the Twilight series.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You ever
I was obsessed with them.
You ever read any romance?
No, I never have. Not really my thing.
Yeah. I haven't either, although I've been reading so much about people who read romance now because the ebook facilitates it, because you don't have to carry the, you know, the bodice ripper cover isn't on the cover anymore. And,
right.
And so it did make me curious. I almost downloaded one the other day just to read it, but I was somehow afraid that, like, I have a shared Kindle account with my wife and kids. I didn't know what that would lead to. okay, so let's look at some questions from readers, listeners. Here's one from Andrew Foster. Andrew writes, "Dear Freakonomics, I have been listening to your podcast, and I just started reading your book. You had a podcast about the lotto, the lottery, and savings accounts. That these were these prize-linked savings accounts that we did a piece about how you can encourage people to save money and still get a lottery payout by pooling their interest and giving them some." And he writes, "With the 84-year-old woman who won the lottery in your episode, it got me wondering, what would you guys do with those winnings?"
Dubner, you know how to spend money. What would you do with the lottery winnings?
Why do you say I know how to spend money?
You live in New York, fancy upstate New York trips. And
fancy,
you know,
upstate New York trips. Like driving into the woods. So I have a little bit of a problem spending money on myself. Sometimes I do, but I have no problem spending money on my family. That's the one thing I would say. So if I had a lot of money, a lot more money, I mean, I feel like I have enough money. But if I had a lot more, I'd probably spend more on my family. On the other hand, I don't know. They kind of have what they need.
For me, because I don't really want – you know me. I don't want anything.
You have simple tastes.
I don't like fancy cars.
Yeah.
The only thing I can imagine collecting other than wanting to have – a private jet, which I would want just because the thing I would love to buy if someone were selling it is time, because time's the thing that I'm shortest on. And a private jet I see as a way of buying a lot of time when I travel, not having to fight the airports and the schedules and just being able to go where I want to go.
Also, you wouldn't have to see any other people, because that's kind of your thing, right?
Yeah, that would be good too. You know what would be hard though is then there'd be a pilot and me. It would just be like a bad cab ride then when you feel like you got to talk to the pilot.
Well,
if there's a lot of people, you don't have to talk to anyone. There's only a couple of you. Feel
yeah,
like
but
gotta,
he's busy. Fine. He or
he's
she.
He's busy. Yeah.
Wait, you know who your pilot would be. If you got a private plane, do you know who your pilot would be?
It would be your brother.
My brother, Joe Dubner, who's the world's greatest pilot, who's looking for
exactly.
a job flying planes.
He's not a talker like you, though, is he?
He is so not. You would love him. He does.
Oh,
he's
great.
Very quiet.
Okay. Well, he's got the job if I can just win the lottery then. There's one other thing that I would collect if I had tons and tons of money would probably be memberships at fancy golf clubs,
mm-hmm.
which would never, ever make sense to do if you didn't have much money because I wouldn't really ever use them. But if I were purely living a life of indulgence and luxury, it would involve flying my private jet to Augusta or some fancy place to play golf from time to time.
Well, that leads very nicely into another question here from someone named Patricia, who says, "Dear Dubner and Levitt, I have a very simple question. What are your current obsessions?" So I have to say, I am obsessed with how obsessed you are with golf. That is my obsession.
Yeah.
You're nuts, Levitt. I mean, let's face it.
I do love golf. I love golf more than any normal person could. But the funny thing about obsessions like golf is they're only fun when you have a nice job and a good family. I've learned that if all I had was golf, I'd certainly want to kill myself because golf is a painful, cruel, unpleasant, constant reminder of how terrible you are at something. And I think you need to have a good grounding to be obsessed with it.
I'm curious, do you think that you love golf so much in part because time is relatively scarce? You know, you're busy, you got a family, you work, et cetera, and golf is very time consuming so that it's kind of the time scarcity means that when you get to do golf, it feels more precious as opposed to having nothing else to do but golf. It would be not so much fun.
No, I think I love golf because I really wanted to be good at it as a kid, and I completely and totally failed. And much of my adult life has been devoted to trying to undo the mistakes I made as a child. And so the reason I've come to love golf so much is that I have had just the tiniest little bit of success but not very much, in undoing my failings of as a child. And so it just is the worst kind of addictive on and off feedback, which drags you deeper and deeper into it. And it also has this incredible attraction to me that while it's physical, at the same time, it's incredibly intellectual, that trying to understand, you know, whether it's the physics of the swing or just the mapping between what happens in your head and what actually is going on when you look at it on video, I find it incredibly enticing and so measurable as well. I love the measurement. So it's almost fiendishly designed to tap into every one of my quirks and make me obsessed with it.
Coming up, how do you make an economist happy? That's easy. Steal his car.
Instead of the dread that most people have about, oh no, my car's not going to be here, I think, oh my, this would be awesome.
And how to eat like a freak.
My tastes go to things like
KFC,
beef jerky,
Chipotle,
Grape Crush,
dill pickles,
chicken wings. I love chicken wings.
You do love your chicken wings.
From WNYC and APM, American Public Media, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Welcome back to Frequently Asked Questions, where Steve Levitt and I answer queries from you, our listeners and readers. All right, here's a question from a Jeffrey Summersill. Jeffrey Summersill writes to say, being in the aerial application business, parenthesis crop dusting, it amazes me how much and all the different kinds of insurance we carry. Of course, this holds true to life, homeowners, auto, health, income, warranties, etc. Just because you have insurance does not always mean you're covered. So my question is, what would the world be like without insurance? Would we be better off or worse? Would people take more care or own junk? What effect does having insurance have on society? So, Levitt, what do you think? I mean, how many different kinds of insurance do you think you own?
I have the absolute minimum insurance. Mm-hmm. I think insurance is greatly – the value of insurance is greatly exaggerated in almost all cases. Many people, I think, don't understand the purpose of insurance. The purpose of insurance, to an economist, is to shift money – to what we call states of the world in which money has a lot of value relative to other states of the world. Okay, let me try to say that.
It was good though.
Okay, so before your house burns down, if you have a dollar, it's not worth as much to you as after your house burns down, right? So if you could magically find a way to trade a dollar before your house burns down for a dollar after your house burns down, you'd want to put more money in the after the house burns down category. This is a world of no insurance, so that you could buy all the stuff that got burned down in your house. Okay, and that is the purpose of insurance. It's a way of moving around money so that you have it when you need it, not when you don't need it.
So why do you think so many people carry – well, I mean, there are a lot of different kinds of insurance, and some of it we have to carry. So right now, you know, there's a debate about the healthcare mandate and people being forced – quote, forced to own healthcare insurance, which is a big issue. On the other hand, if you want to drive a car, you have to have insurance, right?
Right. So that's to protect other people. So the idea is you have insurance so that when you smash your car into other people, someone will be compensated for it. Healthcare, there's good reasons to have healthcare insurance for catastrophic things. Healthcare can be incredibly expensive and it makes sense to be able to, in a pinch, have someone pay for incredibly expensive things that you can't really afford. But the thing that people, I think, forget about insurance is that it's not free to administer, right? There's some big insurance company somewhere with a big fancy headquarters, which is paying for all of the workers and all of the advertising. by charging more for the insurance than it costs them to actually pay out the claims. And so unless you got a good reason to need the kind of coverage, the protection against something catastrophic, you just have to understand that people aren't doing this out of the kindness of their heart providing insurance. They're doing it with a profit motive. And so it's
– And the insurance business model, I think a lot of people don't really get it. And maybe I don't get it either. But from what I see, from what I know, the insurance business model is essentially we sell you obviously what this thing that we call insurance where you give us money now on the chances that we might have to give you a bunch of money later if situation X happens, and we've calculated the probability of situation X and we know we're going to charge enough. But as they're taking in the money now, what the insurance business is really about is investing, right? I mean, that's what insurance companies do, is they take in your money and then invest it and make more money. And that's essentially where their profits come from. Yes?
Yeah, exactly.
So do you think that if people understood that that's the way the insurance business essentially works, that they'd be a little bit less eager to give money to insurance companies?
No, I don't think so. I think it's more fun. I think it's really – I know you're obsessed with financial literacy, and I think this is a case where there's a general idea that's been passed on in our society that insurance is a good thing, that you should be insured, that you should be protected against losses. And people don't actually understand why they should get insurance. They just have been told they should, and they kind of understand that it feels good when you lose something to get paid back.
Well, do you think it's connected to the theme we've talked about a lot of times, which is that we tend to really exaggerate not only the likelihood but kind of the pain caused by anomalous events that turn out to be bad, which are pretty rare and often not as damaging as we think, that people just kind of overscare themselves into buying a lot of insurance?
Yeah, I think people imagine it would be really, really awful if their car got stolen. Right? And it would be bad, right? And it would be the equivalent of, let's say, you got a $20,000 car. Well, you're $20,000 poor. So the question is, does it really change my life if I have my car stolen? If it really changes your life, then I think you should have insurance. But you hit on something important, which is that people are very bad judges of what their how they'll feel in the future. So I tell you, one of the best investments I made in the insurance domain was in buying LoJack.
Mm-hmm.
So as you know, and our readers may know, LoJack is a little hidden transmitter you put inside of in the hood of your car, or they put in the hood of your car. And then if your car gets stolen, then you're able to track it. Okay. Now, most people get LoJack because it's both you get in a deduction off your insurance, and also it's a way of getting your car back when it's stolen. And what I hadn't anticipated when I got LoJack, but what I eventually came to understand, is that the real reason to get LoJack is it makes you want your car to get stolen. So every time I say parked on a different level of the parking lot and got confused and couldn't find my car, instead of the dread that most people have about, oh no, my car's not going to be here, I think, oh my, this would be awesome. God, I hope my car gets stolen. You know, we'll release the hounds and see what happens as we go, you know, on the chase to get the car back. So that to me was the best kind of insurance I ever had, because it transformed an experience, which is in general a very negative one, into one which was actually a positive. And that's something that it's hard for insurance to do generally.
Levitt, here's a note from a reader named Mary Wiseman, who says, "My daughter bought your book because of the, quote, funny title, end quote, and has read sections to us, her father and me, in the car and at home. She's 16. Goodness, what a nerd. So I was thinking that I want to have your book as my book club choice. What I would like to know is what you think the perfect meal is to match up with your book at our book club discussion." Ooh. Apples, oranges, I guess, is the fruit salad you start with, and apple teenies. But holy cow. Levitt, you have any thoughts on a Freakonomics-themed meal?
You know, I'm embarrassed to say that after she sent this email, I spent a lot of time trying to think of the answer. I was trying to think different angles. But, you know, I mean, the apple orange is an obvious, a good one. I can't miss for at least visually. But so I think, well, we don't really talk about food. So kangaroo burgers would be good if you're doing Super Freak, because we talk about the virtues of those for global warming.
Because we should just explain, because, you know, red meat is very greenhouse gas intensive, in part because animals that chew their own cud, ruminants, exhale a lot of methane, which is a powerful greenhouse gas, and kangaroos do not. So kangaroo burgers versus hamburgers, very good for the environment on the scale that it can be. So yeah. Okay, kangaroo burgers, apples, oranges.
Okay, so after that, I think, well, maybe the right tribute would be to eat some of our favorite foods. And she could say, yeah, we talked to the authors and this is what we said. So, you know, my tastes go to things like
KFC.
KFC, beef jerky.
Chipotle.
Grape Crush. Mm-hmm. So I think you couldn't really go wrong with fast food. Chicken wings. I love chicken wings.
You do love your chicken wings. Hey, so how about this? How about she has a potluck supper where everybody brings a food, and then each one has a pay as you wish for each food, and then you could really determine, you know, I guess the appetite and value of each person's contribution.
You know, the potluck is so anti-Freakonomics.
So you think they'd have to? What do you mean? Then they'd have to be assigned what they're bringing?
No. People shouldn't bring stuff. That's so. It's anti-Freakonomics in the sense that, number one, it's got this huge free rider problem that you're making stuff for everybody else. The other thing is it's so inefficient for individuals to make their own food, right? So the only sensible thing to do is to call someone who's good at making food, like a restaurant, and have the restaurant do. I mean, we have potlucks at school, at my kid's school. The only thing worth eating is KFC. You know, as soon as somebody brings KFC because they're too lazy to cook something, it disappears. I mean, it's so inefficient to have people make food at home. I mean, obviously, there's a social component, whatever, but it's total. That's potluck, totally anti-Freakonomics. Can't do that.
Did people frown on the KFC at your kid's school potluck?
Yeah, they frowned on it as they wiped the grease stains off of their the sides of their mouth and pretended they didn't eat it.
Uh-huh.
Actually, to be honest, we slipped it in there real fast so no one could see that's what we brought.
I had a feeling it might have been.
Freakonomics Radio is produced by WNYC, APM, American Public Media, and Dubner Productions. Our staff includes Susie Lechtenberg, Catherine Wells, David Herman, Beret Lamb, and Chris Bannon. Colin Campbell is our executive producer. If you want more Freakonomics Radio, subscribe to our free podcast on iTunes and go to Freakonomics.com, where you'll find lots of radio, a blog, the books, and more.